guys, welcome back to AFTV. This is the Marble Halls podcast, another episode, another appearance with Julian and another guest. So my unspecial guest, less special guest, Julian.
Less special, please.
Okay.
We are all special.
Yeah, okay. Well, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Really excited today. Yeah, really good. Excited.
Good. Would you like to introduce our special guest?
Our very, very special guest is Vic Akers.
Thanks, Vic, for joining us.
Good morning.
So, Julian, why don't you tell me how you've managed to bring Vic on the show today?
Yeah, this was after, for the last 6 months, however, you were telling me that you were going to get Vic Akers on the show.
I was trying.
Yeah.
Vic's here now, so
Vic is here now. Yeah, it's the same result. You were going through your social media stuff and telling me that you were in contact and you're Instering, you're Twittering and everything else, and I just happened to go for a high level executive meeting at a estate agent's, property development company in London Colney called Oliver and Akers, and I walked in. And the first thing I noticed was lots of Arsenal memorabilia. And suddenly property investments in Liverpool were becoming less interesting and lots of Arsenal memorabilia were becoming more interesting. And I asked the gentleman I was meeting with, Mr. Oliver, why he had so much Arsenal memorabilia, being a Liverpool fan. And he said, well, the clue's in the title of our property company, Oliver and Akers.
So,
and Vic is a partner in that business.
Well, yeah.
So I happened to stumble across, and
so you say
here
the power
are.
Of social media is not as powerful.
For someone in their 50s, then no, it's not as powerful. And the power of actually going to meet people in the real world is obviously more powerful because the result is here in front of us.
Yeah,
a very
fantastic.
Special guest.
Fantastic. No I problem. Mean, Vic, we met about 3 years ago, almost 3 years to the day now. It's one of the first interviews I ever did at Boreham Wood when you were working there, which we'll get onto a little bit later on in the interview. But almost feels like a full circle. Better studio, not filming on my phone at the side of the pitch with the wind.
With the wind blast.
Wind whistling.
That's right.
Through the microphone. But I think we can dive a little bit deeper into Arsenal, into your career, instead of just me asking you some very, very brief questions for about 6 minutes after I think it was Boreham Wood versus Salford City that day,
really?
If I can remember correctly. Yeah. But we like to do a little icebreaker at the start of the interviews that we have on our podcast, and it's a very, very basic one, but may throw up some interesting answers or may throw up some answers that we've had in the past, and that is, who is your favourite all-time football player? It could be...
It has to be an Arsenal player, doesn't it?
It doesn't have to be an Arsenal player. It could be an Arsenal player. It could be a men's player. It could be a women's player.
Good.
It will be an Arsenal player.
So? Yeah.
The best male player, I'll give you two, was obviously Dennis Bergkamp. And he was a great pal of mine as well. And was my golfing partner while he was with us. And Kelly Smith as a female.
Yeah.
Was an outstanding women's player. I felt at the time was the best in the world. So they would be my two outstanding players.
Fantastic. I mean, unfortunately, I'm too young to have ever seen Dennis Bergkamp play. I don't think I've seen Kelly Smith play either. So mine's a little bit more modern. I'm a Jack Wilshere fan.
Yeah,
when he was breaking into the team, his performances against Barcelona, which we all can't forget. But I think you've got some common ground with Dennis Bergkamp.
Yeah, it's interesting because everyone we've had on this show has said Dennis Bergkamp.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, I was asked that question. For me, it's Dennis Bergkamp.
Yeah.
It's the obvious answer,
yeah.
Having seen him play.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not a religious person, but if there was a God, there he was in front of me.
There he was, yeah, absolutely. And he was, as you see him now, was how he was, and that was it. Like, you knew what you had. On the golf course, he would always turn up, be immaculate, absolutely.
So he's a good golfer as well.
Decent golfer, yeah.
He strikes me as someone that would be just perfect at everything
he
does.
Well, he wanted to be a perfectionist, I had a story there where we, as a group, I think it was Dennis, my son Paul, who's a kit man at the moment, Dennis and Ray Parler went and played the course at Woburn.
Okay.
Where the other great man as a golfer is known to most, who's the fellow who brought the cup down. He brought the trophy down to Highbury, and we had pictures of him in the dressing room with the trophy.
Okay. Well, who was that?
And I can't remember his name now.
Okay. He was a golfer or a footballer?
No, he's a golfer.
Was it recently?
Fairly recent, but he's getting on now, obviously. But really, used to wear Arsenal gear on the course and things
like that. Wasn't Ian Woosnam, was it?
No, it wasn't Ian Woosnam. God, where can we get that from?
Well, if you stop thinking about it in about 20 minutes' time,
just shout his name out halfway through,
it will work on the subconscious and it will come back.
It will, yeah.
Cool, thanks.
I think I've got one.
You've got another one?
Well, is it an icebreaker question or is it a question that I've just kind of had on my mind for a long time?
All right, go for it.
One of my darkest moments as an Arsenal fan was when we were robbed of the unbeaten run by Man United after the 49th game. But one of my more pleasing memories from that day was thinking of the vision of Ferguson having a pizza thrown at him. Any idea who did that?
Chris, kind of straight to the point, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got every knowledge of that, obviously being in the dressing room at the time. But I think it all came out that Fabregas was the contender for that.
Yeah, we could say culprit, or we could say
contender, whichever way
contender.
We
yeah, I think it was. I don't think it was okay. Maybe it,
yeah,
the manager as such, but I think it was aimed sort of in the direction of
okay
where Man United kids and boys were coming in. So.
So Fabregas was proving yet again how accurate he was with his passing.
Yeah, fantastic pass.
Yeah.
But it certainly wasn't meant, that's for sure, for her Alex. Sir Alex, should I say.
Sir Alex, yeah. That's kind of straight to the point, Julian. I mean, I want to take it back a little bit from that game and kind of just talk about you before you were the kit man in the Arsenal men's team. So if I did my research correctly, so you actually were a left back when you played football,
mm-hmm.
and you played in Fulham's youth academy before playing for various teams.
Yeah, I played in my sort of early years. I played at Guildford City as a semi-pro. That's where I first went out. Well, I played at Hendon first, and then to Guildford City as a semi-pro. From there on, I went to Welling United,
mm-hmm.
And then got selected out of that team to go to Cambridge United as a fully fledged pro, which I accepted because obviously in those days it wasn't about money, it was about being a professional footballer. And for me, it was always a massive ambition. So I actually signed for Cambridge from the end of that season. And so 71, went to Cambridge United with Bill Leavers, the old man Teddy player.
And what division was that?
That was in Division 4.
Okay.
At the time. And I was there for almost 5 years, and we got one promotion in that as well, up to three, and found it, the difference was amazing for me, that the forwards that you played against in one division were so much in advance. So there is a big advantage and disadvantage in both those leagues, and I imagine as you went on again, it would be even bigger.
So the old third division was the highest league you got to, you played in?
Got to, yeah. Enjoyed every minute of it. you know, every day was a special day, and got to meet some great guys and honest people, and you know, honest players, and weren't in it for the money, as I said. You know, could have probably earned more money in a normal job, but the fact of being a full-time footballer was the big, you know, bonus.
Yeah, I have to say that would be my dream job.
Of course,
it would be one that I would do for nothing, and absolutely, I would probably pay to
absolutely
do it.
I'm going to have to agree, but I'm not particularly good. That's why we're here to talk about football, yeah, instead of play.
Yeah, no, I was really good.
Were you?
Well, the older I get, the better I was.
we're all like that. It's okay.
Yeah,
but yeah, fantastic times, and you know, wouldn't swap a minute for it, you know, for all the money in the world. So,
at what age was it that you stopped playing football? Because I saw that you then became the head of Arsenal's community kind of division or section, in 86. Was it? Is that when you?
No, I was still playing at that time.
Oh, right.
Still playing in the lower leagues, non-league, and I ended up playing. Well, I was at Tunbridge at one point with Malcolm MacDonald.
Some of these names go straight over my head.
You don't know who Malcolm MacDonald is?
I think I do. But
what do you think you don't?
You don't know Malcolm MacDonald?
I don't think so.
Have you heard of him? Yes or no?
I've heard of him, but I don't know who he is.
Okay. Do you know what position he played? Know what number he wore?
Was he a goalkeeper?
Oh, get out.
This has gone straight over my head. I recognise his name.
Can we cut the interview now?
Yeah. No, I suppose...
Please, I'm here to learn.
No, look, I suppose,
me and my generation.
Yeah, I suppose this is the idea.
This
is the idea that we're here to teach you. Malcolm MacDonald was a forward. Okay. Super Mac. Great in
the air. I do recognise that.
Yes. He was actually one of the first Arsenal players I remember. He must have been kind of mid to late 70s.
Yeah, probably.
Which is when I started watching Arsenal. He was the...
So about 33 years before I was born.
That would have been it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But I
tend to forget how old I actually am, so
yeah.
I realise that...
I recognise the name, but I didn't...
But then I know who Ted Drake was, and I never saw him.
I know who Ted Drake is.
Okay. Well, if you knew Ted Drake, you should have known Malcolm by then.
I'm very, very sorry to everybody in the studio and everybody watching at home.
No, it's fine. You are now educated.
I am now educated.
All you've got to do is go on your little Twitter thing and look up
Malcolm MacDonald.
Okay, so for...
Super Mac.
So for our next episode, whenever that might be,
yep,
would you like me to come back to you with some research?
Yes.
Okay, I will do that.
Yes.
I will be educated. And Vic, I will let you know as well.
Absolutely.
What I've learned. Cool.
Absolutely.
Perfect. I will do that. So,
and he played at right back and I played at left back, and you know, he was predominantly left footed, but I've been playing
at
Tunbridge.
I did learn that in my research. So he was going to play at left back, but because you were at left back, he played at right back and then became a striker.
Yeah, because
okay,
I've previously been player of the year at
Thank
Tunbridge.
You. I do recall.
For maybe 3 years, I've been player of the year there. So
oh, wow.
Obviously, I was quite strong at Tunbridge, and that was my early years. And Malcolm came in, and he was a very, very confident boy as well, very confident. And went on to major honours and play under the manager that we had at the time, Harry Aslam, who went to Luton, and he played at Luton, and obviously went and played at Arsenal as well.
Fantastic. So
And Newcastle.
So
there's you.
Yeah, his career finished from a knee injury, did it?
I think so. Yeah.
It's got all these weird facts in my head.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
You do. We're gonna unpack a few more as we go on as well. So, you joined Arsenal in their community. Well, what was it at the time? Now there's Arsenal in the community, Arsenal Foundation.
Yes, yeah, right. It was a community base, because the old GLC.
That was a Greater London Council for those that weren't around at that time.
Thank you.
And that was at County Hall, on the embankment. And they wanted to try and get rid of the problems, the social problems in supporters, giving loads of problems off at that time of the game, and put community officers in every football club in the London area, Greater London.
So that was your role, effectively?
And that was my role, to inject a more you know, relaxed atmosphere with the supporters, and we let them join in areas. And I used to run sort of seven-a-side football in the indoor area.
Okay.
There, and sometimes the boys would train in the area in the mornings. And often I was pulled into to sort of sub. If they were one short, then the gaffer would always call me in to play in the games. So
that's just amazing, isn't it? Yeah. It's part of your job of, oh, you can just fill in, you can just fill in left back and train for Arsenal.
Just come in and play with the boys and that, you know. Which is amazing for me, and you can imagine the buzz I got off it. I was on a real high for the rest of the day. So.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But it was an enjoyable job, and from there, I eventually the gaffer come in. I called the gaffer Arson. He came in to take on the role, and everybody, as we all know, is history, and the fact that nobody knew who
he was.
Arsene Wenger was.
That was actually going to be one of my questions. had you actually heard of Arsene Wenger before he came to us? Because I hadn't.
No, I'd never heard of him.
It was Arsene who?
I'd seen him. And when I looked at him, I thought, with respect to him, I thought it's a college guy or something.
Yeah,
you know?
that was going to be my next question.
that would be what you would view of him. I mean,
yeah, they talked about him. They thought he was a professor coming.
Yeah, professor.
In.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he was a professor.
Yeah.
He was a professor.
Professor of economics as well, wasn't he? Wasn't he had a doctorate in economics, master's?
He spoke five or six languages. Unbelievable man. Very, very well educated. But he did actually look like a professor.
Yeah, when he came in with the glasses.
Came in and see him on the steps on the East Stand there. You were exactly what you would have thought of. You certainly wouldn't have thought it was a football manager.
Yeah, it looks like someone's walked into the wrong place and just stood there.
Until, you know, a few weeks later, you saw people like Patrick Vieira walking down the steps.
Well, but Patrick actually came a few weeks before Arsene.
Yeah, but when I had seen him, it was a few weeks after, and I'm thinking, who's this guy coming down? Like, you know, unbelievable.
So how did you go from being in kind of... You were involved with the Arsenal community.
Yeah. And that was around the George Graham years, wasn't it? Came in with Don Howe?
Yeah, it was actually Don Howe who brought me into the club. I'll be forever grateful to Don for that, and obviously sadly passed in the last few years. And he brought me in, and I used to do, obviously, on top of the community work. He wanted me to do some scouting as well for him for the first thing.
Any players that you can tell us you found?
No, I didn't find players. I went out and do
research on your positions.
Okay.
Team assessments, which the team that we played the following week, I would give him a report on in that week after seeing them the previous weekend.
That's great.
Or midweek, wherever it was. But I travelled all over the country for that.
So I'm trying to fill in some gaps of what I found. So you came in 86.
Mm-hmm.
Then I read that in 87 you founded the Arsenal. Well, Women. What was Arsenal Ladies Team, now Arsenal Women?
Yeah.
Was that always an intention when you came in that would be something, or how did that
It just came about because we'd played a few tournaments and that things, and a few women had played, and I had a staff member who was a female. It was a women's footballer as well, which quite interested me. And then I had a few young players, women players, that were coming from Chapel Market, which is locally in Islington. And they suggested, could we make a women's team? And I thought, why not? You know, I'll speak more intent with the girl footballer. And... we had discussions and spoke about what their team was like, and in the end we developed a team from that after me speaking with David Dean, who I must say was my biggest ally in the club at the time, and he's always been a great friend since, and still is. And Ken Fryer was also another person that I could rely on the board at that time. But the board were magnificent. I mean, I had no problem in saying yes, start the team up, and we'll back it. And that was where women's football changed, I think, forever.
Yeah. It was very ahead of its time. I mean, if I think back to way before you were born, Harvey, but I mean, women's football now is a very serious competition. Mm. I don't think it would be incorrect to say that not many people took it seriously back at that time. I mean, my only experience of women's football was watching a film called Gregory's Girl. So the fact that Arsenal had a women's team back in the 80s was well ahead of its time. Yeah. Well ahead of its time.
15 years or so ahead, I would suggest. So
possibly even more.
Yeah, maybe.
Possibly more. I mean, yeah. I think Man United have only had a women's team for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
It was incredibly ahead of its time.
Yeah. But I can remember playing Manchester United in the FA Cup, Women's FA Cup. And they turned up in a bus, which is possibly why women's football wasn't getting presented too much. And it had big banners on Tarts on Tour and things like that. And I'm thinking, my good God.
Yeah. And that was when, in the 80s?
That was in the 80s, yeah. How on earth can they represent Manchester United Football Club?
Yeah.
Which I gather in the end, they didn't really... They had the name of Manchester United, yeah, but they weren't, you know, part of the club as such. And as I said, as we just said there, five years only in the top flight. So it wasn't a great representation of Manchester United, whereas we had gone in at the low level, gone through the leagues rapidly, and gained status to the main league. But they were under orders from me, because obviously I knew, being a lover of Arsenal, being a supporter of Arsenal since I was probably five, and living in that area all that time as well.
So you were born in Islington, weren't you?
Born in Islington, yeah, Essex Road. And just loved Arsenal. Was always there. Every reserve game I'd walk up and watch the games and things like that. And you could walk right the way around in those days. So Arsenal kicking in that end and walk around at half time and go
to the other end,
hoping to see more goals, you know. But no, it was a massive change in the concept of football life, and to this day, we were obviously paramount in starting that off.
Yeah.
And did you ever imagine back then that it would reach the heights that it is now? You know, and the universal acceptance.
Like everything, you hope that what you're trying to develop is going to take off and will be accepted. In the world, because every other country was more acceptant of women's football than what we were. Certainly the more the Scandinavians and in time the Americans. But now it's, instead of our English players going to America, it's Americans coming to England.
Yeah.
So you imagine the change in thought process is unbelievable.
Yeah, no, I remember being on a exchange to Miami University, back in, I think it was the early 90s, and I played what they called soccer.
That's right.
And they had girls playing. I said, well, hang on, why are girls playing? I couldn't get my head around it, and I felt that, you know, I shouldn't tackle them. And no, it's fine, it was accepted in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And I played against, I thought, well, okay, they can play.
Yeah, of course they can.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, it was so ahead of its time. I mean, you went to America and it was accepted there, but in England, it just wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, as the manager of the... Sorry, I'll let you...
Go on, you go.
I was going to say, as the manager of the Arsenal women's team, you won every major trophy in England. Well, every major trophy that Arsenal could, including the UEFA Women's Cup, which is now the Women's Champions League.
That's right, yeah.
Which is just very, very impressive. And I think I read somewhere that you were... made a joke with David Dean about how when you did like the team photo, the women's team would have trophies and the men's wouldn't at the time.
That's right, yeah.
Which is that was crazy.
Often, that was often the case. Yeah. I've actually got photos, which I'll have to send copies to you guys. And
we'll pop them up.
And you can put them up on the screen and show people that it was a fact of life. And, you know, and we had two or three trophies, then four trophies in that particular year, which was 2007.
It's crazy.
It's now 2002 and nobody has still won what we won. at that period.
I think I've 32 major trophies you won.
32 major trophies.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It really is.
So, you know, we should be very proud of what those girls did, and the road that they had to walk down to get there. And I've just seen a couple of videos, films made. One about Jane Ludlow on BBC Wales, if people want to catch it on Catch Up, and Julie Fleeting on Alba TV, about an hour long, both of them, which shows Arsenal in a massive light as being pioneers in women's football.
Yes, it's fantastic. I mean, Arsenal, again, in recent years, Arsenal women in recent years have been playing more games at the Emirates. We were talking earlier about how there was meant to be a North London derby at the Emirates, but then got called off due to COVID, unfortunately. I think the Women's FA Cup prize pot for the
fortune.
Yeah, has been now increased, or will be from next season, I think, which is great. What more do you think needs to happen in order to further elevate the women's game in the next 10 years or so?
Well, it's fairly obvious for me. I mean, and it was obvious back in the time, because obviously we were the team that had come from the professional scenario. And I tried to invest in that, and in terms of my knowledge and what I was with the club, and carried on traditions in the club, and it's only just recently that we lost a tradition that I always felt very close to me, being the kit man as well, in terms of everybody played in either short sleeves or they played in long sleeves.
Have they scrapped that now? It was always the captain that decided and everyone had to follow.
Yeah, it seems that seems to have gone, sadly.
I hadn't noticed that. That was always something that I felt was really important.
For me, it was important, and I fought right to the end to keep it that way.
When did that change?
Possibly it started to change maybe a year before I finished.
And so that was about 2017?
About 16, 17, yeah. I would think so. You know, people were making doing stupid things, and I wasn't best pleased, and I'd gone to the manager about it and said, look, we're either going to continue with this or we're not.
Yeah.
And if we are, then something's got to be done.
So what stupid things like wearing the snoods and stuff like that?
Well, it's not the snoods, it was people cutting shirts off, and I'm not going to go into who it was and where it was.
Okay.
But people cutting sleeves off because they didn't want to wear a long sleeve shirt. And the one guy
was that,
behind
was that Flamini?
In that photograph there, yeah, that's sit on a table,
yeah,
was Sylvain Wiltord.
Yeah.
And he was fantastic about it, because he had never wore long sleeves in his life. But he did for my sake.
Yeah.
In those days. And even if it didn't, he'd pull the sleeves up.
Okay.
Long sleeves. But you could obviously see it was a long sleeve shirt he had on.
Yeah.
And great respect to him, because that he had never worn long sleeve shirts. Sorry, short sleeve shirts.
Short sleeve.
And I think full marks.
Yeah.
You know, because he didn't make a fuss over it.
No.
But that group.
And he respected the tradition, which has been going back for years.
Of course. And that group in particular, Patrick, you know, being France as well, he would have obviously educated him in that fact.
Yeah.
You know, he was a fantastic captain, Patrick, and a fantastic man. And I'm so pleased that he's done what he's done at Palace at the moment, because that was what I thought and thought of him. I thought he would make a great manager.
Yeah, we're all very proud until
Monday.
Exactly.
Then we were less pleased with him.
But yeah, slightly.
Yeah. So you were never upset with him staining your shirts with his Vic every game?
That's right. Yeah. But that was him. You know, everybody has a little tweak of something that they do, and that was him.
What are some of the other kind of like pre-match rituals from players that you've kind of seen? Like, what's the like, you know, in the dress, whether it's, you know, putting your boots on left then right, or your, both socks, or one, like, what kind of things have you seen?
Yeah, I mean, you don't really pick too many up because it's so congested and everything's going on around you that you don't really see what they're actually doing. But there is often that, you know, I could see that he wasn't, this guy wouldn't put his shirt on till immediately before they went out and things like that, you know what I mean? And Dennis would be one of them because he was pristine, he wanted everything properly. And I think those sort of things, they were there probably in front of me, but I never picked too many of them up. But obviously, Patrick, you always see a great blur of the Vic, not me.
Yeah.
listen, that group, as I said, were arguably the best group of players that I've ever had. And to a man, and if anybody stepped out of line, I didn't have to worry about that because
they'd take care of themselves.
The heavyweights would go,
okay,
go and sort them out, you know.
Because you became kit man once Arsene Wenger arrived at Arsenal.
Yeah, there was a year. There was another guy in charge,
Bruce Rioch.
And I think a year that. Prior to Arsenal,
okay,
him coming, he had a kit man,
okay,
at the time, and obviously, at the end of the day, he wasn't happy with what was going on. He wanted a change, and Pat Morris came across to the JVC Centre. He said to Gaffer, he said, "I've got just the guy to do it." He said, and because I'd worked with Pat through the club years, and when I was first there as a coach working with the youngsters and that, you know, with the Ray Parlors as a 14-year-old and people like that. So
what was he like as a 14-year-old?
Still much the same.
Yeah.
Much the same. Got quite a lively boy inside of a kid, and, you know.
He wasn't lacking in confidence then at 14.
Not lacking in confidence, very energetic. A nice kid, really, yeah. Really nice kid. But we try to make all kids nice.
Yeah.
And encourage them and to do the right things and let them learn about the club and the history of the club and what we did and what we expected of them during the club. It's like, you know, same as when I went with the girls, exactly the same thing. In the early years, it took some work to actually get them to understand. They weren't familiar with the goings of what was going on within the club and the history of the club. We had to teach them. And I had to teach him, and we did that.
And someone like yourself, who you are an Arsenal fan, you understand the traditions of the club. I mean, you started to have full access to the dressing room under Arsene, but before that, you were gradually kind of phasing yourself in. And one thing I didn't realise, because I asked you sort of coming in here, where were you sat at Anfield 89? Yeah. And you said, I was at the away end. You were there as a fan.
Yeah, quite.
Quick question on that one. Did you think we were going to win?
Listen, that in those days, you always thought you were going to win.
Yeah.
As you know, because we had such a good group.
Yeah.
Again, you know, there was a group below mine. But you always fancied them because who they were.
Yeah.
And Mickey Thomas.
We'd win because we're Arsenal.
Of course. And Smudger up front, and you know, it was a real group, wasn't it? Tony Adams. I mean, Tony was a massive leader, wasn't he? And Patrick to follow that, I thought, was a marvellous thing for him because he had already learnt off of Tony.
Yeah.
The ins and outs, do's and don'ts, and you know, and as Tony was a massive club man anyway, he would insist on those sort of things being adhered to, and so would Patrick in that era. So. It rolled on nice and easily for Patrick in that respect, I felt. But he still carried it out to phenomenal results and the games and what we played and the record that we had and what we won. Fantastic.
Okay. And back then you had access, you know, gradual access to the change rooms. Any funny stories you can remember from the George Graham years?
one sticks in my head, which we spoke about on the way up, but there was Anders Limpar. I think we were playing Everton. And I think if you look back in the records, I think we beat them 4 in the end, maybe 4-0 or something like that. But I think we were 3 up at half time, and Anders was never really popular with George.
Yeah, I could never understand
I can understand that as well. But on this day, I was watching the game, and I was in the halfway house, or the old halfway house, which people of my era would know, possibly not so much now, because they're going down the stairs onto the pitch. To the left, there was a tea room where we
this was at Highbury.
Highbury.
Thank you, Julius.
Yes.
Thank you.
And in the little box, we used to have staff and non-playing players and things like that, but they would all go in there before the game and at half time. And I came out, and who was walking up the tunnel was Anders Limpar, and I was going back to go into the medical room, which I did quite often, to listen. We had the door open a wee bit, and I said, "Anders, no problem today," because I don't think George really took to Anders too well. He said, "It's a good first half." I went, "Fantastic." I said, "You especially." I said, "2 goals, you're going to be great today. You have no problem at all." And then we shut the doors and everything in the dressing room, and George started. All of a sudden, I can hear him ranting, like, and I'm thinking, who's he ranting to? So I said to Gary Lewin, "Gary, who's he ranting to, the gaffer?" He went, "Anders." I went, "Anders?" He said, "You sure?" I said, "He's just scored 2 goals, been outstanding." He said, "Yeah, he's got a problem with him."
and
I think that was it. He did have a massive problem with Anders, George, and I don't know for what reason, but obviously, somehow it didn't work for him.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of meeting Anders Limpar a couple of weeks ago, and I thought he was joking, but now he's, it kind of, it makes sense.
Falls into place, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Anders Limpar said to me that George used to call him a little shit, and I thought it was like a term of affection, because a lot of people call me a little shit, amongst other things, and I thought, oh, thank you very much. But obviously it wasn't. He did have a major issue with him.
He must have had a major issue, George, yeah. But that's the way it was, though. I mean, football's about opinions, and obviously in George's opinion, he wasn't doing something that he wanted him to do. And I would have thought it was more on the defensive side than the attacking side.
Yeah, you couldn't fault him.
He liked wide players to tuck in.
Yeah.
And if he wasn't doing that, then he'd obviously be onto him, on his back all the time. And that may have gone on for weeks, because I wasn't always at every game. I was sometimes out scouting and stuff. So I wouldn't have known that. But I did hear that, obviously, George would have got into him more than anybody. And that would probably be why, because he'd be consistent in what he wanted to coach. And if he'd been coaching all week, that if you're playing Anders, I want you tucked in here, and if he wasn't doing it, then of course he's gonna fly off the handle again.
Yeah,
because we worked a week on it, and you're still not doing it. You know.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds harsh to me, but then I can't fault the results of George Graham years.
Not at all.
We had success.
Yeah.
And it was success of a level that I'd never experienced as an Arsenal fan, and it brought me the greatest moment of my life,
of course,
which was Anfield 89.
And we had probably the best defensive record in our time, I would have thought.
Yeah, and the greatest defence in the history of football, bar none.
And
I'm not biased.
And at training grounds, and when he did training sessions, George, he used to work on that back four with a rope.
Yeah, I heard that. That was actually true. I thought that was a rumour.
Oh, no, it's true. He had a rope. 20 yards, maybe long, with a knot in the middle of one end.
Yep.
There's you, Tony, there's you, Boldy.
Yep.
Nigel, Lee, hold on to the end of the rope, and you went in tandem. You went across there, you went. And there's your mark where you want to be at, you know? So that's the line. And that's what I used to work on. It was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And I used to watch and admire, you know, what he was actually coaching there.
You know. Yeah, with the with a rope, it's not really something you really nowadays. I don't think
it'd probably be illegal nowadays,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. No, against some sort of EU law.
You had to do, you would move the ball.
Yeah,
you move the ball, and they would have to move
with you. Yeah,
and go with them.
Yeah,
so it's like tugging people over.
Yes,
coming over, so tugging the people back. Getting people in the right position.
So in effect, what you're creating is not 11 players, you're creating one unit.
Unit of four, yeah.
Yeah.
Defensive unit.
Yeah, but that's what football's about. Football's about a team. It's a team game.
Yeah.
It's not an individual game. So that particular exercise, you are becoming one. You're not thinking individually.
Yeah.
You're becoming a unit.
A unit, yeah.
It's rational. So it's rational.
Exactly.
It's clever.
So simple.
Yeah.
Simple, but magnificently clever for me.
Yeah.
So, are there any kind of, I don't know what the word would be, almost like tricks that Wenger would use, similar to the rope kind of training technique that George Graham used? I mean, I know when he came in, he kind of took some things that he'd had in Japan. I think it was you couldn't wear shoes in the training ground. You had to cover your shoes with like little black bags. The nutrition was a big thing. Yeah. Was there any kind of other
all of that.
Of weird ones?
Obviously, the not wearing boots or shoes in the area. When the players came in, they would have like we've got over there, the boxes. There were a number of boxes in the foyer, which they put their shoes in, and they would already have left their flip flops, I'll call them. From the previous day, and they wear them into the changing rooms so as not to take any mess or dirt and rubbish into the changing room. Wanted to be hygienic, and also he would introduce dressing gowns as well when they're in the shower room or lounging around or having treatment for injuries in that room. They would always have dressing gowns set up and hanging up in the de-roving room, which we had. So it was, there were certain things like that. Obviously, water was paramount in their drinks. Wasn't a massive believer, I don't think, in some of the drinks that were formulated, like the Gatorade-type drinks. And would back one or two others and always have them around for the players.
He wasn't a big believer in the Tuesday Club drinks either, was he?
No.
He kind of got rid of that culture very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, he was responsible probably for extending certain players, i.e. Tony Adams, Ray Parlour, Martin Keown, Boldy. Their footballing lives by probably 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And on him just coming in, so I thought that was phenomenal, think that them players could have extended their careers by doing what he suggested that we do.
I mean, from what I've read, the main difference was sort of George was very much the disciplinarian of it's all about hard work. Arsene comes in and he brings in techniques that probably we hadn't embraced in England at that time.
Yeah.
A lot of stretching, a lot of diet, which now seems
so normal.
But back at that time, it was, from what I understand, it egg and chips for a pre-match meal, out the night of the game, the night after the game for drinks.
Yeah, of course.
It was a different lifestyle. I mean, how quickly did the players embrace this new
very
kind
quickly.
Of
and were there any that
regime?
Didn't
very quickly
everyone
bought into the fact of what he wanted to achieve and what he was doing, and obviously when success was coming on the pitch as well.
So it came very quickly,
and I think that then everybody just bought into the fact that whatever the gaffer said, we're going to do, and I think he had Tony Adams on side, obviously, and Tony was feeling that much better for it as well, and was extending his career, so straight away he's going to buy into it, but the fact that everybody bought into it was a big thing in the club, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, it was some time ago, but I'm trying to think back, and I couldn't think of any players that, when you think about managers coming in, they always have issues with a few current players, and they kind of have a bit of a clear out. But back then, I remember him bringing in new players, but I don't remember him kind of cutting any of the more established players. Yes, some of the peripheral players went, but I haven't got a vision of or memory of any of the sort of more established stars just sort of kicking back. It did seem like everyone was in agreement.
With respect, I mean, when you look at Gaffer, I mean, he wouldn't miss a trick, and he realised that we had in front of us the most experienced and probably arguably the best back players that we've ever had at that time. So all he needed to do was create in front of them a football team that could deal with them and assist them in any way, shape or form, which is when he bought Vieira and Petit, who, powerful players, but outstanding players, in front of a back four. Imagine playing with them in front of you, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying about a lease of life for those lads, you know? It made them feel, and probably 10 feet taller,
sure,
having them players in front of them.
Okay.
And then to go further on and have Bergkamp and people like that out there, and then have Thierry Henry come in, and I know he didn't perform that well in the early months.
No, I
didn't
rate
it. Six months or so before he really took off.
Yeah.
But once he got the feel of things and he got, you know, to know about English football, there he was, isn't it?
Was the feeling around the club that Thierry Henry was that great player? He just needed time to click, or was it a surprise, as much of a surprise to the people inside the club that he turned out to be the success he was?
I don't think anybody thought, you know, badly of the start he had made. I mean, I think everybody would have thought, listen, if Arsene's brought this guy in, he's got to be good.
You but know? Not everyone Arsene brought in was good.
No, not everybody. But
well, definitely not that good.
No, not that good, that's for sure. And for him to make a career at Arsenal the way he did, you know, was phenomenal. And turned out to be a really nice fella as well.
Yeah.
Know, for me personally, I mean, I had great relationships with most of the lads because I treated them with respect. I didn't get in on top of them, or, you know, get busy with any of them. I just made sure I'd done my job and looked after them. And they all appreciated that.
Okay,
so I think that's what the role is of a kit man.
Sure, and you mentioned that Bergkamp was your favourite ever player,
mm-hmm.
But from a personal perspective, who were you closest to? What player?
Dennis.
Over the years? Yeah. Dennis as well?
Yeah.
So feel the jealousy.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
steaming out of Julian right now.
We used to play golf together.
It's amazing.
We were golf partners and played at Mill Hill. We both joined Mill Hill at that time. And I was playing golf the other day on a charity golf day at Tring, and the guy that came with Anthony, my partner in the Anthony and Oliver regime, he played at Mill Hill, this yep. guy, and he said, I can remember Dennis playing there. He said being a member and everything. I said, yeah, well, I was the little one playing as his partner probably most of the time.
Imagine he's my best friend, Dennis Bergkamp. I mean, I actually had a girlfriend for 2 weeks that lived.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I've had girlfriends for slightly longer, but 2 weeks is kind of the average. And she lived next door to Dennis Bergkamp.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I'd like to say that I'm deeper than there was other attractions, but I have to say one of the big attractions for me was that she lived next door to Dennis Bergkamp.
This was many, many, many years ago.
It was 99, and I was actually invited to Dennis's surprise 30th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't. She was with guest, and I was the guest. And
really?
the party was on the Sunday.
Well, I bet you peed your pants then.
I actually cried myself to sleep for 2 days because she dumped me on the Friday.
Oh.
And it's the only time in my life that I've cried when I've split up with a girl.
Really?
Yeah.
It's quite a nice story. That's quite funny.
It's good, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, wasn't at the time, but I'd like to say I've got over it, but
it's 23 years
you
ago.
Clearly
thinks about it all the time.
I clearly haven't.
Oh, no, that's great. No, that is yeah, Dennis, imagine, I just can't imagine like being just close to any Arsenal players like now. It's even just when I mean, I've had a couple of conversations with Bukayo Saka before, and he's my favourite current Arsenal player, and it's just like, he's like so close to my age, and it's just like, you're there, and it's just amazing.
Yeah,
it is. Same kind of way.
But he's a lovely boy, eh?
Think about it. Yeah, have you met a lot of the current Arsenal players?
Well, not too many. Of the young ones that have come in, but my boy said that he's my son.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to.
He said Bakker is top.
You can just tell.
And Smith Rowe.
You can just tell that they're kind of, and again, the two of you will know and be able to say this better than I can, but you can look at players like them and you can see they kind of, I don't know, they just are Arsenal and are kind of the closest in terms of like their passion for the club and their understanding to the club than any kind of Arsenal player for a while, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's true. But what is worrying is that the fact that have we gone from the old Arsenal, and are they being taught
the same traditions?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I want to see them wear the club blazers again.
Yeah, that'd be lovely, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I met Perry Groves again on Saturday at the game, and he was wearing a club blazer.
Yeah.
And that meant a lot to me. It's the tradition of the of Arsenal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I've still got my existing jackets or suits, hanging in the wardrobe. Don't probably fit me now, but I would never get rid of them because obviously that was all part of my life and my Arsenal life. So that's the difference, I think, in terms of, you know, where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, you left Arsenal in, was it 2018?
Yeah.
And your son took over your role. Yeah. How does that kind of feel?
No, Paul was with me before that, so we were both working in the same job. So you know, I was teaching him the ropes of what happens and stuff like that. He had already grasped that because he was one of the ones that would come out golf days and things like that with us all. And I think that he has got less involved now because he's about to leave, sadly, this year, and he finds the job that much more demanding now, and having to go away to sort of areas like America, and people think, oh, this is great, like, you know what I mean, but he's ending up last year, or when they were last in America, doing 16-hour days.
That's crazy.
Which is madness. And you know, you can't expect people to want to work in that environment. You know, you've got to show some compassion somewhere along the line, and I don't think that's happening at the moment. So he's prepared to go, and which I find disappointing because that's the Acres name out of the club, and that disappoints me.
Yeah.
So the decision's definitely been made.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
It's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah, but I tried to talk him out of it, but he said, Dad, he said, I barely see the kids now. He's got two young kids, and he said, I barely see them. He said, I've got to spend some more time with them.
How's the youngest one?
Well, they're 14 and 12 now.
Okay, so if you can just hold out maybe for another four years,
it'll be all right.
Keep them going.
But he's had all that time, and you know, he's missed so much. You know, that's the issue, I think, with it all.
What changes have you made in the role from when you were there to now that to make it more? Is it the fact that there's like more? Well, I'm not going to say there's more games because there's not really. But
imagine the staff behind the manager.
Yeah,
for a start, Arsene. We travelled with probably 9 people.
Oh, well.
Now they travel probably 20. So straight away, you go to Crystal Palace, you can barely get in the dressing room with two teams of 12 or 15.
And everyone's got to have a
kit. And now, of course, they all want to put kit on, don't they?
Yeah.
Half of them, I don't know why, but there you are. That's my view.
Yeah.
And it's unnecessary. Surely it's unnecessary.
I suppose it's a bit like John Terry in the Champions League final.
Yeah.
He wore his full Chelsea kit. He didn't even play.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm. But
and his shin pads.
But I can understand that, in fairness, because he wanted to pick up the trophy.
Yeah.
The first time picking up the trophy, that was.
Yeah, I can understand it. I just don't like it because it's John Terry and Chelsea.
Oh, yeah, of course. But, I mean, they nearly came back from the dead this week, didn't they?
Yeah, nearly.
Yeah.
You know, got so close.
Yeah, so close, but so far for Chelsea, such a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really upset by that
you,
one.
You're disappointed, weren't you?
Oh, devastated.
Not at all.
I could hear from your house in Bounds Green there.
Yeah.
But listen, that's the way the football life is, and it's changing, and it changes yearly. And it's got to the point where you have to be very careful, because you can drop over the line and people not being interested in those sort of jobs. Everybody thinks, what a job you got.
Yeah, just get close to what you love, kind of thing.
You must love it all the time. Certain times you have a problem with it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think if it does become vacant, I would be interested in that job if I could become best friends with Dennis Bergkamp.
No, you won't get him, unfortunately. But, I'm sure there are others in the group that, you know, you make.
I mean, I'll happily become best friends with Saka if that's available.
Well, there you are. You've got it all going on.
Yeah. There we go.
So if we go back to the Arsene Wenger years, just a couple of questions from me. What was the best team talk you ever heard him give?
You're going to be surprised by this, because he would come in and not say too much. If he made one point, he would make sure that point was got over and everybody understood it. Or he made one change, that was what he would do. Rarely did he come in and shout and scream, which I think if I heard him maybe lift his voice on one, two occasions over the period that I was with him, which is nearly 20 years, always kept his calm, always took everything in perspective, and just made the point of what we needed to try and do to change the game. And that would be it. Because you can't send different players out with different information all going through their mind and expect results.
So it was a very focused point that he'd make.
It was a focused point he would make. And that was it. And he wouldn't let anybody come in and say anything. Or the rest of the coaches, he wouldn't let them speak, because he felt that what he had to produce was something that was instant.
Okay.
So by only having that one point or 2 points being made, everybody was available to take it on board.
Okay, so Steve Bould never got a word in then?
No, Steve never really spoke, no. Pat never really spoke.
Okay.
One point and that was...
Very occasionally.
And when was the times you said over the years you saw Arsene lose it once or twice? When was that?
Raise voices, but he would raise his voice. And again, I don't think he meant to say it, meant to do it, because... I was, you know, shocked for him to change his mannerism, because it wasn't one of shout and scream. That's not me. You can't remember. You don't remember the games, but that was him in his entirety. So rarely did he ever get wound up to the extent that his voice was raised.
Mm.
And I admired that in him, in fair. Venice, and I always took things from what I saw at the Gaffer do into my side of when I was with the girls. I tried to establish how he worked and how I would work, and so I became that much more mellow with the girls as well. I felt maybe the girls would say something different, but that's how
was the intention.
Yeah, that was the intention.
So you left at the same time that Arsene Wenger left.
Mm-hmm.
Was that coincidence?
Not really. I'd already spoke to him earlier in the year to say, well, we was in America 2 years prior to that, and I said, I'll do another year, Gaffer. In the end, I did 2 years after the American tour, and I said, I'm definitely going to go, Gaffer. so I told him 2 or 3 months in advance. I said, I'm definitely finishing at the end of the year. And he said, okay, Vic. He said, I understand. He said, at the moment, I'm not sure how I'm, where I'm going to be as well. So I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. And I hope it works out right for you. And I said, but I do want to thank you, you know, for all the years that you've given me and the inspiration that you've given me to give to other teams in the club, like the girls. And that was the way it was. And really nice man to talk to, understood everything, and was very compassionate in after you served his time with him.
Yeah. I mean, the speech he gave on the pitch.
Fantastic.
It was a fantastic, very moving moment for me personally. I'm sure many people in the ground.
I think so.
But he hasn't come back to Arsenal. He hasn't been seen in the stadium since. Does he feel bitter about how it ended? Did he feel forced out? Or did he feel it was time to go? How much of it was his decision?
You'll never know, will you? Because obviously that's the man he is. He's.
Did he confide in you at all?
No. He's. That was the only word he said to me when I said I'm definitely going, Gaffer. I said at the end of the season, and all he said was, "I might be gone before you." But he said so.
Did it sound to you
it
like?
It sounded to me as
like
if,
you wanted to, or
you don't know, do you?
Don't know.
But
yeah.
That's what I took from it. You know, I thought, oh.
Do you think he was unfortunate
sad.
In the way that he left as well, or do you think?
Listen,
because
you have a shelf life,
and
let's be fair. We had 20-odd years of the gaffer. And I always talk about him as the gaffer. You know, even though. I had a gaffer in George as well, and at the club. But George was totally different to Arsene, and I just felt that what he brought to the club was phenomenal, which we've already spoke about, and the change, the overall change in the club was phenomenal, and the results in the club phenomenal. I don't think we had bad words for him, in fairness, and don't forget. We built another ground in that period leading up to, you know, the poorer times and more difficult times where we play in the Europa League rather than the Champions League.
Yeah.
And that's not coincidence.
Yeah.
That's not coincidence.
I mean, he was under
a lot of pressure financially, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, I look back at it now. I think we all do.
Yeah, everybody reflects
it. Yeah, and at the time we thought, you know, this top four being a trophy, what he came out with and... Okay, we weren't that impressed just to get top four.
No.
But looking back on it, was his best years, all those years he got us into the top four and didn't necessarily win a trophy under those restrictions, or was his best years when he was invincible? Mm. It's almost like the achievement of getting into the top four has been underestimated.
Yeah.
Of course. But I think we were robbed of the trophy when we went to Paris, and I think the Barcelona game, I think, was definitely tipped on its head when the goalkeeper gets sent off.
I mean, all the ref had to do was let
the ball.
So
straight away you think, God, we've been denied a penalty.
Yeah.
Which I think we'd have scored straight away because of Thierry Henry.
Yeah.
And we've had a player sent off next to nothing.
All the ref had to do was play the advantage. Barcelona would have been 1-0 up. I don't know if you remember it. Was how old were you? About
three.
Three. Not bad at maths.
He was rolling around on the floor. Wasn't
yeah. But the Barcelona player put the ball in the net. I think it was was it Eto? Can't remember back then.
Could have been.
Put the ball in the net. The ref blew for the foul, sent off Lehmann, and gave Barcelona the free kick, which they didn't score from.
Yeah.
So I think it would have been better for the game. Keep 11 against 11. And
history could have been very, very
let it
different.
Be 1-0 to Barcelona and it would have been game on.
Mm. I mean, when you look around now at the refereeing over the last 12 months, it's gone so ridiculously the other way. You think, I look at the game last night and you look at the Atletico Madrid's players and what they're doing on the pitch and not getting pulled for it. And you think, good God, what are we doing? Where are we going with this? It's all very well letting people, you know, make tackles and then just wave it on, and, but they're going to hurt somebody seriously at some point. And I mean, look at Foden, come off there like you've been in war.
Okay,
well, I've got a question. I think you've probably answered it already in some of the things that you've said, but for you, who's the better manager, Jules Graham or Arsene Wenger?
Well, I have to say Gaffer, because obviously he took me in as well under his wing, and I spent 20 marvellous years with him, and he did change the game in this country. He did change the game, and I was very fortunate to share those moments with him.
Okay.
And will always be indebted to him.
And which team did you rate as the greatest team to play against Arsenal in all the years you were there?
Arsenal versus Arsenal in training.
that was nearly my answer. Probably Man United, I would have thought.
Which Man United team?
When we, well, the gigs in that top.
The 99 one.
When we lost in the semi-final. Yeah. Dennis missed a pen.
Yeah, that was
probably the team that gave us most problems.
Yeah, I mean, we were very close to winning the double that year.
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
We should have won the double. They should have never won the treble.
Mm.
We should have won the double. Let them have the, well, let them have missed out on the Champions League. But unfortunately, history says something else.
Yeah, yep. It does.
Unfortunately, it does.
Yeah. We're starting to come to the end now. I've got a couple more questions just from me. So we've had Keith Edelman on the podcast previously, who was managing director at Arsenal, if I remember correctly. And he spoke to us about, and we've kind of touched on this too, about the end of the Arsene Wenger era, but he basically was talking to us about like the restructure of the club once he left, and how it's kind of different in the back, like technical director and CEO and whatever else the titles are now. Is that kind of where Arsenal is? Well, I mean, obviously a football club is a business, but is that where it kind of goes away from the traditions that we kind of spoke about, and goes more into just going along as a business? What are kind of like your thoughts on the new direction of Arsenal?
Obviously, you live in an era which is so successful, and as a supporter, I'm still living in that era with a gaffer.
Yeah.
And obviously there are certain things that you see in the club, and we understand that it's a business, but there are certain things that I wouldn't have liked to change, really. Because I thought we were going on a good way, and obviously it's changed. You know, we've had two managers, it's two managers, isn't it, since then, and Has it changed the playing ways? I don't see it too much. I know we've incorporated some young players that have come through the ranks, which is great, fantastic, because that's what we always wanted to do. But at the same time, we're not seeing the success that we had in those days.
Yeah.
So I'm for old school, sadly.
I'd bring back the police band at half time.
Yeah, exactly. The half time scores up around the corners.
Yeah.
No, well, it's difficult. It is a difficult time when you, as you say, it is a business. But I've never looked on football as business.
Yeah.
I've looked on football as football. And I've worked in those areas of football, not business.
Yeah.
And I just found it much, much better then. And as I say, too many people, too many staff being involved can only cause a problem, because that's too many more opinions that you got and people making comments, and you know what I mean? And I don't see how that can work. I don't honestly see how it can work, I've got to be honest with you. But we've been fortunate. You've signed a new goalkeeper this year, who I thought has been outstanding.
Agreed.
And then I was sitting in my seats in the stand, and people were saying, "What they bought the goalkeeper for?" I said, "I'll tell you why they bought the goalkeeper. I said, because he's going to be one of the best. And I said, he'll play at Reading this year.
Well, there you go.
And he did.
Yeah, and he will.
And he will.
And he'll be the future, well, be the England goalkeeper for years to come.
Yeah.
If he carries on like that.
And that's the difference. But that's my football. I'm not a businessman. I'm not, you know, to think about, you know, pounds, shillings and pence, that's not me. I'm only in it for football and the club itself and the way we play. And that's all I want to see.
Amazing.
A name has just popped into my head.
A golfer.
Ian Poulter.
Yeah, that was the one.
That was the one.
Let me just briefly tell you the story of that, because that was what I was trying to get to. Ian Poulter's, it was his golf club, Woburn. On the tee, Dennis Bergkamp. I'd already played reasonable one up the middle. My son Paul had already played, okay again, Ray Parler. It's a good one, really good one, straight down the middle. Dennis, last man to play. And you can see he's under pressure. I went, "You all right, then?" He went, he said, "I don't like it." I mean, he said, "This is worse than playing in front of 50,000 people." He said, "I'm not happy." He said, "I'm really nervous. The most nervous he's been. Unbelievable." And always behind us was a couple of professionals with Ian Poulter.
Yeah.
Watching him. And that was what put him under so much pressure. And I think the Iceman was really melting. And at that time, it was unbelievable. I couldn't believe what was going on. He went, I said, "Come on, then, you'll be all right. No problem." Anyway, he hit one straight down the middle.
Oh, he was...
The relief you could actually see physically coming out of him, that he'd hit one really down the middle.
Mm. Well, it's a shame he didn't have that mentality in 99 when he took the penalty against Schmeichel in the FA Cup semi-final.
Yeah. He never did too much wrong for us, though.
Let's be fair.
I mean, let's acclaim what he did and as a person and as a player. Fantastic. Newcastle.
Yeah.
Leicester. Best hat-trick I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, the Newcastle, I think it's been voted the greatest Arsenal goal ever.
Really?
Yeah.
I think so.
Good.
That's great.
Deserves it.
But he wasn't that great at penalties, weirdly enough.
Yeah,
I think he'd missed three out of the previous seven penalties before he took that penalty at Villa Park that fateful night.
Listen,
not that I'm bitter and twisted.
Listen, as football supporters, we always have to take the good with the bad.
And we
had a lot more good.
We have.
We had bad in those years.
I will always be grateful to my father for taking me to Arsenal in 76 rather than taking me to that place up the road.
Exactly.
Think about the misery I would have had.
Well, being coming out of Essex Road and my family living in most of Caledonia Road as well, so I was a born Islington boy and played for Islington schools and everything. So I was delighted to, you know, be part of this club and to actually leave a legacy in regards
to
the women.
Yeah.
So for me, it's been a fantastic time.
And have Dennis Bergkamp as your best mate.
And as Dennis has.
I think that's a great way to end off with talking about Dennis Bergkamp at the start and talking about Dennis Bergkamp at the end.
Finish.
Oh, I'll talk about Dennis Bergkamp all day.
I think we could do a whole episode on Dennis. Listen, if you want to help him get on the podcast.
I just sit here for an hour going, Dennis. Dennis.
What can I do?
That's great.
No, thanks, guys.
Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Coming on, Vic. There's so much more I reckon we could talk about. Maybe we'll see over the next few months if we can
get back in the autumn or something.
Yeah, and dig into some.
See how we start off the new season.
Oh God, we'll see. We'll see. I hope we'll be talking about Champions League football. But yeah, thank you to everyone at home for watching as well and listening. If you're listening on one of the audio platforms, we've learned so much. Me and Julian love to learn. So, we'll see you on the next episode and we'll see who we've got next. But again, Vic, thank you very, very much for joining us.
My pleasure, guys.
Thank you.